Okay, thank you. Let me first thank the organizers for the opportunity to be here again and give a presentation. So actually, I'm going to report on work done in collaboration with various people, with some permutations of these names. And that deals with the Landau-Ginzburg description of topological deep brains. And this builds on work done especially by Koncevic, Orlov, Kapustin, and others. And there was also some more recent, closely related work. Now, the whole talk, the content, I mean, the topic is very broad. So I decided to give a more pedagogical overview, a talk for non-experts. So I will spare you of spectral sequences and these kind of things. But I will take a physicist's point of view. So now does this work? Yes. Okay, so at the beginning, I will just say a few words about the motivation in order just to give a hint to people completely outside of the field why one is interested in these kinds of problems. And then I will turn to discussing open string topological field theory. And actually, this will be very closely related to what Ezra was discussing yesterday from a mathematician's point of view. So I will present a physics realization of a very explicit and concrete realization of these more general abstract structures. And then I will switch to the boundary Landau-Ginzburg formulation and spend most time of the talk here in this topic. And then at the end, I will show how to marry these two issues, these two aspects of topological field theories in order to do explicit computations. I will especially spend quite some time on the minimum models and also will discuss D-brains on the torus, which is a very sweet and pretty well understood subject. And if I have time, I may say some words on the extension to Calabrians. So this is just one, two, three transparencies to give some kind of introduction. So what one is interested from the string quantification point of view is Calabrian manifolds on which we compactify type 2 strings, and in general there will be some fluxes sitting in them on related to some non-trivial submanifolds, and we will have D-brains, and they either wrap certain internal cycles or they can also stretch over space-time, and we can imagine living here on the world volume of these D-brains in a way having a brain world. And if you cook this up in the right way, we will have an n equal 1 supersymmetric theory in four dimensions, for example. And the obvious, interesting, important question is, what is the effective superpotential? What is the exact vacuum structure of the theory, and so on? And certainly, there will be many moduli in the problem. So we will have closed ring moduli. These will be denoted by Ti throughout the talk. So they govern the sizes and shapes of these various high-dimensional cycles in the Calabi-Yau. And then on top of that, we will have also open string moduli, which correspond, for example, to the locations of D-brains, but also moduli related to structures on D-brains, like bundles or other brains bound to them, and so on. So this is, in general, a quite complicated situation. And the important thing is that notions of classical geometry, such as a P-cycle and wrapping a brain around it and having some gauge fields or B-fields on top of that, and so on, these notions make only sense, really, in the large radius limit of the compactification manifold, where the signal model is weakly coupled. Only in this region here, we can draw such a picture. Because of that, most explicit constructions, say, of more phenomenological models are tied to this kind of weakly coupled region. However, if you go away from this weakly coupled large radius point in the moduli space of this Calabi-Yau, then the Virchow instanton corrections will become stronger and stronger. And at some point, these geometrical notions will be wiped out, and strange things can happen, such as that the 0, 2, 4, and 6 cycles will be on equal footing, and so on. So sometimes one has another method, you know, to understand what's happening here in this quantum regime. For example, one might have an exact rational conform amplitude description at a Gettner point, and then one has an exact solution of the theory at this point. But that's a rational conform amplitude description. This means one does not really understand how to go away from this point. So what one really needs is to have a formalism that is capable to describe abstract D geometry, but not just the classical object that I was depicting here, but sort of more abstract. There should be more abstract definitions of D brains, which are more general than these naive pictures. And one would like to understand these pictures as as we go around in the modular space, over the Boolean modular space. So this, of course, has been a subject, an intensively discussed subject over the last couple of years. And certainly, there exist very well developed techniques such as mirror symmetry. So mirror symmetry allowed to do many important, achieve many important insights. But I should point out that this is really well developed only for non-intersecting brain situations, non-intersecting brain configurations. Essentially, nothing is really known for intersecting brain configurations, and also mostly for non-compact geometries. So in particular, the topological vertex and what's behind it that applies, it does not apply to intersecting D-brains, and also is for non-compact geometries. So what we are going to do to make progress on this front? The mathematicians, hey, what is this? Hey, well, let's go back. This is garbled for some reason. Anyway, maybe it's not an accident that just on this page when I talk about mathematicians, some things happen. Because whenever one puts derived category, one is inclined to put the whole thing all over with spectral sequences and whatever. So that's exactly not what I want to do. I just want to summarize in a few keywords what sort of the advantages of this language are in from the viewpoint of a physicist. And I will come to the point that actually all what we really need to understand as physicists is the Landau-Ginzburg formulation of this problem, which more or less captures maybe all, maybe an important part of the derived category. And I'm talking about topological B brains here. So first of all, that was supposed to mean that the derived category is more general than K-theory, so it contains much more information than just the RR charges. It keeps track of the positions of brains. So in the derived category, a D0 brain in one point of a manifold is considered to be a different object as another D0 brain sitting on another point of the manifold. It treats the brains and anti-brains on more or less equal footing. And such as can, it describes, or it allows to describe bound state formation processes. So one can understand Tapian condensation in a systematic way. And also what is important for us, it is pretty robust under continuous deformations. So this goes far beyond of what one can do in rational boundary conform field theory. So all of these features can be found in this Landau-Ginzburg theory I'm going to discuss. And I will give you a brief overview of how things are supposed to be how they fit together. So there's a category of topological B-type on B-brains. And as I will point out, that is more or less the same as the category of matrix factorizations. Then this has a close relationship to this boundary Landau-Ginzburg theory I'm going to discuss. And finally, that, of course, is a particular realization or manifestation of a certain open string topological field theory. Yeah? So that's the line of thoughts, and I will start here with from the end, because that's the starting point is most familiar to the physicists. Okay, so what do I mean with a category of topological D-brains? I'm not going to give any precise mathematical details. Just for a physicist, it's enough to know that the object in this category consists of objects and maps between them. These correspond to the D-brains, and then we have maps called morphisms, and there are two sort of different kinds. One kind, endomorphisms, just map back to the same D-brain, and then we have more general ones which map between different D-brains. Yeah? And such a picture is, of course, well known to be called a quiver diagram. Now, in the conformal field theory or topological conformal field theory language, these D-brains, of course, can be detected in this way. They correspond to boundary conditions in this two-dimensional field theory. And I emphasize here that these D-brains can also intersect along submanifolds, which is usually not considered. And as I was saying before, a parallel D-brain, which is the same R charge than this one, but placed at a different location, is considered to be a different object in this derived category. So there are new maps coming into the game. Now, as for the morphisms or maps, they correspond to the boundary-preserving and boundary-changing open string vertex operators. So the endomorphisms, these maps which are related to one brain, they just sit anywhere on one of these brains. These are vertex operators just describing the emission of open strings from these points. But the boundary-changing, these morphisms correspond to the boundary-changing vertex operators. So they sit on the intersection of these brains. So why are they called boundary changing? Well, that has the following meaning. We have, say, we consider string perturbation theory, say on a disk, and we have here some piece of a Riemann surface, and the boundary of this Riemann surface sits here on this B-brain configuration in some way, and it can cross here this intersection, and the boundary preserving vertex operators, they sit here somewhere on one of the brains, but the boundary changing vertex operators, they sit here on the intersection, and this means, viewed from this boundary here of this Riemann surface, they switch the boundary condition here between brain A and brain B. So that is sort of how this abstract mathematical construct is related to the conformal field theory language.
Can you explain how the morphism is composed?
Well, obviously. Yeah, of course. I mean, there are arrows and they,
Or not a composed arrows, but points of intersection, I think it's composed.
Oh, no, it does. There can be further intersections, there can be, on further submanifolds and so on, and you just place these vertex operators on these intersections.
But
no problem with that. Actually, I will exactly come to this later in an example. There's a chalk here. So you could have D-brains which sit like this, A, B, C, and you can have vertex operators going between A and C, C and B, and B and A. So this corresponds to a quiver diagram with D-brains A, B, C, and this guy corresponds to this map, and so on. So this shows how the maps compose. No, it's not zero. Well, I will show later. There can be instanton corrections to this, and this will be a holomorphic disk, and then this gives an instanton correction. And holomorphic what? Disks? Oh, sorry, this is a mirror picture, of course. Yeah, this is Abrams. Yeah, yeah, indeed. I was trying, yeah, but this is exactly what I'm going to discuss later for the case of elliptic curve. So one has, that's a mirror image of the B-model computation. Okay, so from this figure on the previous slide, it's clear that the general disk correlator has this structure. It has some boundary and some bulk insertions, and then according to the rules of, you know, open topological strings, one has to fix on the many insertions, you know, to fix the symmetries, and one can have then an arbitrary number of integrated insertions. Yeah? So one can, in general, one has a mixture of integrated and not integrated insertions. Yeah? And there will be a generating function, which in the appropriate context will be nothing but the effective superpotential in four dimensions. Yeah? Will be the generating function of these disk correlation functions, and it can be formally written in this way, yeah? And one can expand it, this is more or less the definition of it, in terms of correlation functions times deformation parameters, and these deformation parameters, you know, they are the TI, which correspond to the bulk deformation, this means they correspond to closed string vertex operators sitting in the interior, or they can correspond to boundary moduli or deformation parameters which is on the boundary. Yeah? So one has this kind of expansion, and these correlation functions are defined in this way. Yeah? One has to have, one has a certain number of unintegrated insertions, which means either three unintegrated in the boundary, or one at the boundary and one at the bulk, which is depicted here, and the rest is integrated insertions. And one can show, which is slightly non-trivial, that actually these correlation functions integrate. This means the bulk insertions can be described by taking derivative of a generating function. Yeah? So this is pretty much analogous to what is known in the usual bulk n equal 2 superconformity theory, where the correlation functions are given by derivatives of a prepotential. Here it's different because in the boundary sector, yeah, we have these extra boundary labels, and in the boundary sector we have no symmetry among these indices. They're only cyclically symmetric. This means we cannot describe this correlation function as derivatives in a standard way. One can define formal non-commutative superderivatives and this kind of thing. But a priori, one cannot really integrate these correlation functions. And this means one has to deal here with an infinite sequence, in principle, an infinite sequence of prepotentials. One may think that the bulk prepotential is F just sitting on top here. And then for each cyclic orbit of boundary labels, one has a prepotential. So that's the structure of these correlation functions. And then one can ask, can we somehow find the consistency condition these correlation functions have to obey in order somehow to solve the theory at some point? And we recall that the analogous equations in the bulk theory were the Wittgenstein-Dyckhoff-Winde-Wellin equations, which are well known. It just corresponds to their crossing symmetry for, well, the bulk conformal field theory, and they just take this highly nonlinear form. Okay, so what is the analog of these equations for the boundary theory? And there's a whole variety of different kind of relations, and this has, of course, very much to do with what Ezra was explaining us yesterday. So first of all, in the boundary topological field theory, we have a factorization equation, which comes from requiring that the BST operator kills this correlation function, and because we have integrated insertions here, and whenever this Q hits one of these D minuses, we have a contact term, which means a boundary term, and so on. This means only the factorized, one has a sum over the various factorizations, which has to vanish. Huh? And by defining here so-called string products Rm in this way, these are the correlation function, here we put some of the fields, then these equations turn into so-called A infinity relations, which is an a priori infinite set of nested or recursive algebraic constraints, and they have the form that Rs, which are essentially correlation functions, depending on the fields but also on other Rs in the middle, summed over that this has to vanish. And it is known from Koncevich that, in fact, indeed, the deep brains in these open strings form a cyclic A infinity category, and this is exactly what is expressed here. Yeah? Cyclic means these indices are, these correlation functions are invariant under cyclic permutations, they are multiple signs. But there's more than this, because beyond infinity we have other conditions, and these have to do with inserting extra bulk deformation operators on the correlation functions. And what these do is more or less to deform these undeformed open string correlation functions into perturbed ones, which depend on t. So this reflects this integrability property I was referring to, and there's a whole mathematical machinery behind this which comes under this name Hochschild complex. But since Ezra, as a mathematician, didn't want to define it yesterday, I'm not going to define it today either. And it doesn't really play a role for us. So we have these conditions, so one of these conditions is the so-called boundary crossing symmetry, and I think that's one of the various figures Ezra was writing on the blackboard yesterday. So we just have like an operator product between two bulk fields, and then split this apart and factorize the amplitude in this way. And this can be translated, after all, in some complicated formula which contains derivatives with respect to bulk moduli, and one has some kind of nested structure. So moreover, there's this well-known Cardy condition, which just corresponds to the factorization of the annulus amplitude into closed and open string channels. And this also can be written in a way, as a differential constraints on the correlation functions. Yeah? So this may look simple because one thinks, oh, one just puts some operators here and takes derivative and that's it. But I just want to assure you that's not the case. Certainly these equations reflect the consistency conditions spelled out first, I think, by Moore-Segel and many others, I think Ezra and probably Costello more recently and so on. But in practice, it's pretty hard to show explicitly that they are true. Particularly with integrated insertions, so we have to deal with integrals. So this is a sketch, intermediate step of the complicated computation. And one has to deal with the boundary terms. In particular, one has to deal with the proper compactification of the moduli space. And here all these strange objects Ezra was talking about yesterday appear in some disguised form. So one has to do some real complicated mathematical machinery to make this really well defined. I mean, this is a question of regularizing the amplitude subpropagating. And Manfred Herbst, who was my student at that time, did a great job in really figuring this out explicitly. Okay, so this is a summary of these factorization conditions. We have in the bulk VDVV equations, then we have infinity constraints, then we have a crossing symmetry, Cardy condition, and so on. So this looks very awful, and indeed that's in a general infinite system of coupled differential and algebraic equations which have some recursive structure in them. But the question is, of course, can we do something with them, and can we ever hope to solve them and do something, obtain explicit results? So that looks pretty formidable, and in order to proceed, we certainly need to specify now what kind of theories we're talking about. So we have to specify the spectrum of the spectrum, the BST cohomology, what are the indices referring to, but also we need, because these equations have a recursive structure, we need to have some kind of starting point, which means the three-point functions and the boundary bicorrelation functions. So these need to be supplied from some other means. And starting from them, we can then evolve the other correlation functions by these equations. And that's where Landau-Ginzburg theory becomes very handy, because that's tailor-made for computing three-point functions and so on. So now I switch tack here and switch to the boundary Landau-Ginzburg description of D-brains. And this has been discussed relatively often here, I think, by various people, by Hori the other day, so I will be quick here. So we consider a bulk Landau-Ginzburg model with some superpotential. And then we consider B-type supersymmetry variations, and as usual, Lagrangians are only invariant after total derivative under supersymmetric variation. So this means in the presence of a boundary, we pick up a boundary term. And this goes under the name Wonner problem. And it turns out that this can be solved by adding boundary degrees of freedom, boundary fermions, pi, which can be put into some sort of superfields, which look like chiral superfields, but they are not quite chiral, but they, you know, the bar of pi give some other functions e. And if we add such a boundary potential, pi times some arbitrary function j, then it turns out that this extra boundary term cancels this variation if j times e satisfy this factorization condition. So in other words, whenever we have a Weitland-Ginzburg theory described by a potential w, then we can obtain supersymmetric configurations whenever we have a factorization of w in two functions, j and e. So this now links to some interesting part of mathematics, going under the name matrix factorizations. So let me just reformulate this in a little bit. Yeah. Having such a structure, yeah, means we have to, we need also to know what the BST operator is and what the open string spectrum is. And the BST operator is just given by J and E, yeah, which can be written in matrix form. And therefore, the factorization condition is really the condition that Q square goes into the Weitland-Ginzburg potential. And certainly, one can generalize this also to several fields, and then these polynomials J and E becomes just become matrices. Yeah? And the statement seems to be, I'm not sure what really, you know, the general validity of the statement is, but it seems that the category of such matrix factorizations is isomorphic to the category of B-type D-brains in the appropriate nice context, I think, in particular for hypersurfaces in vector projective spaces. And tomorrow at 11, I understand, we will have a discussion about how to prove this.
What is the M?
N? M or N?
M.
Oh, manifold M. Calabiau. That's the direct category bounded of Cohen sheaves on M. No, no, no. M is fixed. And well, I come to examples later. But a particular factorization corresponds to a particular D-brain configuration.
On a particular M?
No, no, on the given M you started. The M you started is defined by the Weitland. This could be, for example, the quintic superpotential, for example, for describes the quintic. And then the factorizations of this in terms of E and J, of matrices E and J, would give you the statement as all the B-brains, B-type of B-brains. So what is the physical interpretation? Well, these things are nothing but chunk pattern, degrees of freedom. And actually, the idea which goes back to Kapustin and Lee and Lazzaroyo. And the idea is that actually you start with a higher dimension than the DD bar system. Yeah, and J and E are just the tachyon profiles whose presence make these DD bar pairs condense to the D brains we talk about. Yeah? So, for example, if you describe the zero brains, and this is what we're going to do in a moment for the minimal models, then you can think of the zero brains as the result of a tachyon condensation of D2 bar pairs. Yeah? The condensation process is, you know, implemented by these boundary potentials J and E. So the zeros of these polynomials, for example, correspond to locations of the D brains. So here we go. This will be a major part of the talk. Yeah? Here we go and discuss the minimal models, which of course have no good geometrical interpretation. But at the end of the talk, we will come to the elliptic curve, which does have a nice geometric interpretation. So that's just the simplest possible case, so that's why it's rewarding to consider it. We have this potential here, given by x to the k plus 2, this describes a minimal model at level k. And the dbrains are just described by all possible factorizations, which is, of course, very simple. These are just these, the splitting of x to the k plus 2 into the product. And this just matches exactly the list of possible boundary conditions, beta boundary conditions in the conformal filter language. And also the open string spectrum matches precisely, and they are just determined by the cohomology of this BST operator, which was given by E and J and E. It takes this form, and then just solve these equations, and one obtains the open string spectrum. So that one can, whoops, and can write down a list. Whoops. And the details are not very important. One just has a cohomology in the boundary preserving sector. This means these are the open string excitations which are tied to one and one brain only. And then there's a ring structure of the open string operators. One has a bosonic and a Fermi generator, and the Fermi generator squares the bosonic one. And then one has also a cohomology in the boundary changing sector. This means one has cohomology states between two brains, ML1 and ML2, some similar structure. And the spectrum is just determined by the mutual divisibility properties of these various potentials. So one has one J and one E. In this case, they determine the relations in this ring. And if one has several brains in this case, then it's the mutual divisibility properties. Okay, so that's enough for this. And now the interesting part is that and actually, that's the starting point of the story. Koncevich introduced a category CW, W having the interpretation of a superpotential. And it turns out that this physical Landau-Ginzburg model is just a physical realization of this abstract mathematical structure. So the objects in this category are these modules here. So the objects themselves correspond to some complexes, and the maps the boundary potentials correspond to maps here in this complex. And antibrains can be described by swapping J and E, so this corresponds to the so-called shift functor. And more interesting is then the open string spectrum between two different brains, ML1, ML2. This can be disentangled. These two entries here, they correspond just to the matrixness of these equations, but they correspond to the Chan-Patton labels. And one has various maps between them, and these maps are correspond precisely to the cohomology, to the physical states I was just showing before. So we see here that the mathematicians were smart enough to cook up an abstract framework, and the boundary Landau-Ginzburg theory really gives an explicit realization of this. So we can go on and do more. For example, we can now study perturbing this theory, and can study the deformation space, or modular space, if you want to call it this way. So we perturb these potentials generically at first, and then we will have generic effects as follows. First of all, the factorization J times E equal W will be lost. This means supersymmetry will be broken by such perturbations, but we expect that in this combined parameter space, supersymmetry will be restored along certain submanifolds. So one task is to find these submanifolds, and along those, one has a boundary flow, the open string spectrum will truncate in a certain way, and in general, one will also expect that in a multi-brain system, certain composites or bound states will occur and so on. So all of this can be now studied very explicitly, but to really do this, we need to really solve the theory and determine all these correlation functions, or all the discorrelation functions in particular. And the interesting result is as follows. When we apply all these consistency conditions, all the correlation functions on the disk are uniquely fixed, up to trivial rescalings and so on. And in particular, applying only the A-infinity constraints does not fix the correlation functions completely. There are three parameters undetermined. And only after applying the other conditions, such as the Cardy condition, it really fixes all of these correlation functions. So this is sort of interesting. We know that the infinity relations, you know, do not really determine all correlation functions by themselves. There are these theorems about quasi-isomorphisms and so on. Now, there are certain transformations which are compatible with the A-infinity structure and so on. So A-infinity is not expected to determine the theory, but we found that when, if you really take all the consistency conditions together, then all the correlation functions are uniquely fixed. And moreover, one can write the effective potential, which is a generating functional of the discorrelation functions, in a very compact form, which just involves the Balkland-Ginsburg potential, which takes here this Dijkstra-Velinde-Velinde form in flat coordinate parametrization, times log dead j, where j is this matrix-valued Tachyon profile, and here I have written it for a two-brain system. One brain, another brain, and the off-diagonal terms correspond to the morphisms going between the brains. This is minimum model. This is just AN minimum model, and one obvious question is, of course, how it's for the other minimum models, which have two variables, like 3, 6, and that's what my students currently are investigating. But the interesting thing is that via residual formula, one can rewrite this potential as trace V, where V has a property that its derivative is giving the Balkland-Ginsburg potential, and the X here becomes a matrix X, which is a diagonal matrix, and the eigenvalues of this matrix are the same as the eigenvalues of that J, which are in a way the brain locations. But this V, whose derivative gives the Balkland-Ginsburg potential, is nothing but the super potential of the Kontsevich matrix model. So it's known since, I don't know, 10, 15 years that somehow the Kontsevich, the Danilus-Kontsevich model has to do with minimum models coupled to topological reality and so on. There was lots of research in all of this recently. However, all of these considerations, they do not really, well, they always have these variables, but they not really have these open string variables in this way. And also in these matrix models, the matrix X is going to be an n times n matrix where n goes to infinity. Here, X is a finite matrix, and it's just corresponds exactly to the V brains we have here, and it's just a finite number. So that this comes out so nicely is very non-trivial and really means that all these consistency constraints make sense and are correct. Okay, so one can study now the properties of this parameter space, for example, the critical locus. One can take the derivative of WF, can be very simply shown that if this is zero, then, that is zero when E minus, which means the negative part of E, the negative powers of X, vanish. This means this corresponds to the factorization locus, and I can prove it also the other way around, and this means the matrix factorization locus over the parameter space corresponds to the critical locus of the effective superpotential. That's exactly what one wants to have, namely matrix factorization corresponds to unbroken supersymmetry in two dimensions, and of course the effective potential, the critical locus should also correspond to unbroken supersymmetry. And that's sort of similar in other situations, like in this Dijkstra-Wafer approach to gauge theories. It's always so that the critical locus of the effective potential corresponds to a factorized geometry. This is. Here, actually, there are more open string moduli, namely Fermionic ones, and they're suppressed. They're set to zero here. These are the bosonic open string variables. The other ones are sort of pathological, and we suppress them. So one can now go on and study sort of what happens over the parameter space very systematically. And I just say this because, you know, these kind of ideas come from mathematics. And now we find a very simple physical model, a very concrete application of these ideas. For example, we have a boundary-changing Tachyon profile J. We can have one V-brain, another one. We switch on one off-diagonal boundary-changing operator. And that means But this reflects what is called the cone construction in mathematics. It just means that if you switch on an open string wrap between two d-branes, then we will have a bound state or a composite called the cone. And this is just an explicit realization of this. And one can also study by you know, tuning the parameters, whatever one switches on here, and reproduce flow patterns which are known from boundary conformal field theory, like one brain, another one, going some of decompose in a different way, or n-fold tensor product of one brain goes into some combination of brains with coefficients here given by the issue to fusion rule coefficients and so on. So this is a fairly complete story, and I think apart from extending this to the D and E series or the mini models, that I think is sort of closed up. Now, let's come to a physically more interesting case, namely to the elliptic curve. And that's the simplest Calabi-Yau, if you like. So that's why it's, of course, extremely important and interesting. So for a cubic torus, we have, well, a superpotential of this form, yeah. And the B-type D-branes can be characterized by two numbers, N2 and N0, where this is the number of two brains and N0 brains. And in geometric language, one can call this as a rank of some bundle and a gauge bundle and the first Chern class. And in the mirror language, well, these D2 and D0 brains become D1 brains, which can wrap around in a PQ type of manner around the fundamental cycles of the torus. So A brains correspond to windings P and Q, which correspond to these numbers. And so on the covering space of the torus, one can now write here various brains. And it turns out, by explicit computation, that the minimal brains here, the short diagonals, correspond to 2 times 2 matrix factorizations, while the long diagonals, in a way long diagonal because we talk about these parallelograms here, the long diagonals correspond to 3 times 3, or rather 4 times 4 matrix factorizations. No, no. The whole point will be to have to have the whole picture for all values of A. No, this is not A. This is actually the other modulus. That's not A. This is an A model. And that's also a Kähler parameter in the game, which is sort of, on which this theory does not depend on, that refers to this picture.
The A model would be not too
A. Yeah. So we want to find a matrix factorization for this cubic potential, and that was done in a nice paper by Hori and Johannes Walcher. So there is so these matrices are 3 times 3 matrices. We consider on the case of these long diagonal brains, because for some reason they seem to be simplest. And so one can make an arbitrary ansatz guided by symmetry and charge considerations and so on with some arbitrary functions here. And it turns out that indeed these matrices factorize, you know, when multiplied together, give the cubic superpotential back, if and only if these parameters which appear here, these alphas, satisfy the cubic equations themselves. Which means that the moduli space of this factorization is the torus itself or the Jacobian of the torus. So this is exactly compatible with the idea that we have these zero brains which can sit on every point on the torus. Yeah. Now, actually, it's known what kind of functions solve these cubic equations. These are certain higher-level theta functions with third characteristics. And from this point of view, one can parameterize the moduli space by brain locations ui, which live on the Jacobian. And then one has also a tau dependence, which corresponds to the flat coordinate in the B model, or which corresponds in the mirror picture then to the Kähler parameter of the mirror model. Yeah? So these, we know already sort of what the geometry of this configuration is. We know already what the flat coordinates are, which are just points in the Jacobian or the modulus of the torus. So in this case, we don't need to worry about how to find flat coordinates. then one can solve for the BST cohomology given this Magnus factorization or given the BST operator. And one has to work a bit harder, and one finds that the right flat representative of the cohomology are given as follows. First of all, the maps which map back to the same brain, the endomorphisms, they are just given by the U derivative of the BST operator. And then one has the boundary chaining operators which go between. And actually there are triplets of them, and one way, this way, they are all fermionic, and going the other way, they are all bosonic. And let's write just down the fermionic ones that are given again by matrices and with some coefficients, and again these coefficients turn out to be theta functions now with a bit different arguments. It's of course expected because every sensible function over torus has to be a section, and these are just theta functions. Okay, and then we can go on and do the following. We can compute three-point functions. So we want to compute in the effective Lagrangian, or the generating function here, we compute a correlator of three these tachyonic or boundary changing operators, and that's a correlation function, and we just insert these matrices we have been computing into this residual formula of Kapustin-Li, which is a generalization of a residual formula written on by Waffa many years ago. And by just doing this and doing sorting out some subtleties, one finds that these Yukawa couplings, these three-point functions, are given by these Q series, where Q is of course the exponential of e to the 2 pi tau. And so one thing, for example, one sees here immediately, these functions, they're not symmetric under exchange of ordering, under changing the ordering of the fields. So the 1, 2, 3 is not the same as 1, 3, 2. So one has to distinguish these terms here in the effective Lagrangian, and that sort of shows clearly this non-commutative nature of these kind of correlation functions. Xi is the sum of all the U's. So we talk about a three-point function between three brains, 1, 3, 3, 2, 2, 1. So we go exactly make a three-point function of this kind. And each brain has a modulus U, so it can shift around. And the result, this thing just depends only on the sum of these. And these correlation functions have been found by Cremantes et al. Before, but essentially by looking to, well, there's an elementary geometric way to determine them, but they also have a nice paper out later on where they do some interesting B-model computation. So this reproduces these results, and the question is, what is interpretation? And of course, now we invoke mirror symmetry, and we now talk about A-model and correlation functions related to 3D1 brains. And so we can write down sort of like the fundamental region of the elliptic curve in this way. And the three types of brains we talk about go in this way. Of course, they can always be shifted by changing this modular UI. And the point is that this Q dependence here of these correlation functions corresponds to Wurmschmidt instantons, which are disks which are bounded by these 3D brains. So that is what it's about. So this correlation function C132 will have a leading instanton contribution given by e to the area of this instanton here plus lattice translates. And all of these correlation functions depend on the modulus of the torus, so on the shape of this parallelogram, but they also depend on the locations of these brains, on the UI. So that's what this interpretation is of these correlation functions, and gives a very clear physical picture. Now, what one can do, and that's work in progress together with Manfred Herbst and Denis Nemeshansky, one can consider the higher point correlation functions. And as I was saying before, one can invoke these A-infinity relations to generate the higher point correlation functions once the three-point functions are known. And so the geometry of this is very interesting. These correlation functions, as these consistent conditions correspond to factorizing certain correlation functions, and it has to do with composing or decomposing polygons in terms of triangles or smaller polygons. So in a way, you could say that these A infinity relations in this context are reflected, or in the leading order, it corresponds to the composition of areas here of this virtual instanton. Okay, so that works out very nicely. Of course, that's no accident that this works. I mean, certainly that doesn't that doesn't fall out of the air just like this, but it's well known from the mathematicians. It reflects exactly the so-called homological mirror symmetry between the derived category of Korean sheaves and the B-model, and the Fourier category related to special Lagrangian one cycles, as formulated by Kontsevich. And there has been work 5 years ago by Polychuk, who more or less solved this homological mirror symmetry on the elliptic curve in a pretty complete form. And he showed that from the mathematician's point of view, this mirror symmetry works because of certain theta function identities. So they describe not only the boundary changing field isomorphisms, but also the D-branes. They represent them as sections or theta functions, and then there are certain theta function addition formula which are behind these correlation functions, as we would say it. And so for us, it works in the following way. In the Landau-Ginzburg approach, we have been seeing that these fields, these psis, depend on theta functions, Landau-Ginzburg fields x, y, and z, and theta functions. And multiplying them together and computing the correlation function boils down exactly, so if you consider an operator product or chiral ring operator product of two boundary fields, it involves multiplications of theta functions. And essentially, ultimately, it boils down precisely to the theta function identities invoked by Polychuk. So again, we see that this Landau-Ginzburg approach just combines neatly and just expresses these abstract mathematical ideas. So what can we do beyond A infinity? No, what is this? You can see this now here. Okay, and play. So far, as far as I know, the mathematicians have been dealing only with this A infinity structure. So the question is what comes from the Cardi condition and so on. And so the result was that these correlators are always theta functions if they are three-point functions, or generalized indefinite theta functions if they are higher point functions. And as such, they satisfy the heat equation, which is a defining differential equation for the theta functions. And in our way of understanding so far, this follows from some certain operator products between the boundary and bulk fields. But it seems to us, but this is work in progress and is not quite conclusive because it doesn't quite work yet, and we are really puzzled by this. But it seems at least part of this equation is built in the Cardi condition. So there's some extra terms which do not vanish, and if they would vanish, we would say that this heat equation would follow from the Cardi condition. So that's not really clear. But it could mean something more deep. First of all, such an equation reflects the reconstruction of the closed string sector in terms of the open string sector. In a way, you change a bulk modulus, and you can readjust this by changing boundary moduli or vice versa. And it might have also something to do with, in some indirect way, with background independence. Because you could say, in these models, the bulk modulus is not a physical operator at the boundary, it's a BSD trivial operator, but nevertheless, the correlation functions depend on the tau. So in a way, there's an anomaly, so tau dependent of the correlation functions. And somehow you could say that the tau dependence, this analogous dependence on this bulk modulus, can be compensated for by variation in the open string modulus. So there could be some interesting interpretation behind this, but okay, that's work in progress. So let me come to the conclusions and outlook. So we have been saying that the category of matrix factorizations describes I'm not sure, you know, what to what extent, you know, how general this is, but it seems to be very general. The derived category of Cohen sheaves on the manifold M, and in physics, it corresponds to the boundary Landau-Ginzburg theory, related to matrix factorizations, and this gives an explicit realization and very tractable realization of the open string CFT. And with this, one can represent all the quantities in these quiver diagrams. Usually, if people talk about categories and so on, they make lots of errors in various diagrams, and then they say, oh, we have a superpotential of the form X, Y, Z. But here, we really have these quantities depend on the moduli in a well-defined manner, so we really can discuss superpotentials depending on moduli and investigate how these things behave over the moduli space. So as I was showing, one can now, well, invoke mirror symmetry and put things a bit together to include to compute instanton correct superpotentials. And the new feature here is for intersecting plane configurations. So there's currently no other way I would know which would be able, no other method which would be able to do this. And this is also work in progress, which bothers me now since a year or so. And the point is that in the bulk, the VDVV equations, they're very nonlinear equations, horrible looking ones. It can be expressed as some kind of flatness equation. But they can be linearized, and there are other equations, the so-called Picker-Fuchs equations, and those are enough to really solve the theory and determine the correlation functions. So this is a type of connection, and the Picker-Fuchs equations act on so-called period integrals, and there should also be, to some extent, some kind of analog of this story here for these open string deformations. And that's part of the story. So it works in some way, but not satisfyingly yet. So, but what one would hope for at the end is then to generalize all of this to collabial threefolds. Say, for example, on the quintic, one has this kind of quiver diagram. These are these five special L-equal zero brains. And people have been computing the effective superpotential before. This was implemented in many terms. However, this was done in boundary conformal field theory, so this was done typically at the Gapner point, and there was just a number here, one typically. Now, if that would work, we would be able to, for example, determine the Kähler modulus dependence of these coefficients. So one could interpolate between the Gapner point and large radius point. And
B, right?
Huh?
We are still talking about B.
Yeah, these are these L equals zero, 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 zero brains.
But we don't
see. I think we have. There will be instanton correction to these terms here. Sorry, of course, in the mirror. This will be some function of whatever variables, but in the mirror, this will be dependent on T, and this will be the Q series, roughly speaking. And so, coefficient of these Q series supposedly will lead to new enumerative invariants, so much as the theta functions for the torus. T is a Kähler modulus in the mirror model, or it's a complex structure modulus in the original theory, but in a flat basis, flat coordinate. Okay, so that's it. Thank you.
Well, there's a sort of fundamental question I've got, and I'm not sure if this is the right, with all these people here, is the right place to discuss it, but let me ask, and if it's an easy answer, if it was. So, you have chosen your closed states. They're labeled by cohomology classes, but at some point you've chosen explicit
representatives. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And likewise, you've labeled your boundary states by open states by cohomology.
Yeah.
But you've also chosen lifts.
Yeah.
And so the formulas you've got depend on choice of widths.
Indeed.
How do we know we can squeeze out some useful information when there are so many choices?
That comes. This is at the core of the problems I have, namely. Shall we go back maybe here? So the question is essentially, what does anything depend on the particular representative we choose here for the type? Actually, this correlation function is invariant. It doesn't change by addition of exact pieces. So that's fixed, but the problem is that there's a normalization for each of these pies. And essentially the result of this is 1 modulo the normalization coefficients. And the issue is to find differential equations for these normalization coefficients.
So
the
3-point does, but the 4-point higher.
Yeah, yes. Yes, that's, yeah, I would be glad to discuss. That's at the heart of problems I'm dealing with, right? I'm aware of this problem, and that's, I know. Yeah. So for the 3-point functions, all of this boils down to determining the coefficient of normalization of the size. But higher point correlation functions are not uniquely defined over there. There's a built-in ambiguity. There are various things. First of all, I'm not talking so far about. I would be glad to be able to do this for the QMT just for 3-point functions. The problem is not there. For the higher point functions, it may be, if it's like for the minimum models, which is not clear, for the minimum models, the Cardi condition was putting extra constraint and was fixing all correlations uniquely. So all this arbitrariness, which is reflected by these quasi-isomorphisms, was eliminated by imposing the Cardi condition. So we are not done with this conclusively for the torus. It may be that all is fixed when we impose all the full set of consistent conditions. And if not, then it's also no big mistake, because we know the result is unique only up to field redefinitions. This is at the heart of the problems.
Thank you.